Okay, good morning, everybody. Oh, these are cool. Nice flashcards. Can you get these in the bookstore or where? Where did you find these? Borders? Borders has nice flashcards. Yeah, they got muscles too, probably, and everything. You just can't carry everything around at one time. All right, so this is Bio 231. It's February 25th. And if you want to look at some nice flashcards, tackle this woman on the way as she leaves class and ask her where she got them from. Borders, okay. All right, so we're going to finish joints today and move on to the muscle system. We're going to start looking at how we name muscles and things like that after we finish up some joints. And let's see, next time we don't have a lecture. I have a vacation day because I don't have to lecture. But what do you guys have next time? That's right, you have a test. So let's see. Yeah, you have a test, March 2nd. Yeah, that's Monday. And it's going to be on chapters 6, 7, 8, and 9. All right, these last four chapters that we've been looking at. So make sure you bring a Scantron that isn't mutilated or spindled or smudged up, a good pencil and a good eraser, and that's all you need. You don't need any electronic devices like a calculator or anything. Oh, and I've got a sign-in sheet for today. I'm gonna give you mine because it's easier for me to use. All right, so make sure you sign the sign-in sheet. I'll trade you sign-in sheets for it. Okay. Yeah, so thanks. Yeah, you'll definitely, I'll pass this out in just a little bit. I want people who are late to get here. Yeah, please bring your Cypress College picture ID, and then you'll be ready to turn your test in. And of course, make sure on your Scantron also put what version of the test you have so I know how to grade it. Oh, I do have a comment. I have a number of students this semester that have changed their name. And it's really hard, if just one or two students change their name, I can kind of keep track of it, but if there's a whole handful or more, then I get really confused. So make sure on your Scantron you put the name that you have in registration. So otherwise I won't be able to find you, okay? And I know that a lot of people have hyphenated last names. So pick the last name that you use in registration. Don't, because some people, I think, choose different last names depending on how they feel, okay? Which is kind of fun. But it would help me a lot if you just use the last name, okay, that you have in registration and I can find you. Because I think I have 14 sections this semester. So you'll get lost. So that means I can get the grades online sooner, like probably 2 or 3 days sooner, okay? Yeah. All right, I'm trying to find an instructor that will have an open lab Friday or maybe even Saturday. I'm not sure. Okay, so I'm asking to find, but no one has volunteered to do that yet. All right, so there's no open lab scheduled, so you have to check your emails. As soon as I find out, I'll email the class, and hopefully, if you're interested, you can take advantage of that. Okay, yeah, so I can't say for sure at this point in time. But I've laid a big guilt trip on a lot of people, so we'll see what happens. But don't forget, that's just a volunteer effort on whoever shows up. Okay, so does anybody have any questions? No? Okay, well, it's always good to start out with some questions. So, since you don't have any questions, I guess I'll ask you some questions over what we were talking about last time, and this is actually kind of fun and easy part of anatomy, and that is motions. All right, so what kind of motion is this right here? That's flexion, and this is extension. So how do we characterize that relationship between these two motions? They're antagonistic motions, right? But is that a good thing or a bad thing? That's really a good thing because that means you have precise control and balance over your body if there are antagonistic mechanisms controlling something. And I said that's the most important concept in this class. And we first now see that concept in terms of the musculoskeletal system. But when you take a physiology class, you'll see how that works in terms of the nervous system and endocrine control and all kinds of different systems use antagonism to maintain control, precise control and balance over your body. So antagonism is a really good thing. All right, now, so that was flexion and extension. And remember, when we talk about motions, we can talk about a joint in particular, or we could talk about a part of the body that is moving. So for instance, this right here is flexion, but flexion of what? Or how? What kind of flexion? Flexion of the forearm, because the forearm is moving, or you could say flexion at the elbow. Either one of those are good ways to describe flexion. Okay, that the motion that I'm going through right now. All right, so then what is this motion here? What is this motion? Like that. What is that? Okay, what are the two ways we could talk about this motion? Okay. What was this? Okay, and this is? That's flexion too, because the angle between my trunk and my thigh is decreasing, right? That's a classical definition of what flexion is. So you could say flexion of the thigh or flexion of the hip joint, right? Either way. And actually, you might want to say that out loud so that you can actually kind of get that ingrained in your mind. All right. But then last time, kind of as we were wrapping up, I showed you a motion that is really hard to appreciate by the classical definition of flexion or extension or abduction or whatever. And that's this motion. What is this? So what is this motion? When I raise my humerus, you know, up and anterior, what is that? Okay, that's flexion. Okay, that's flexion. Flexion of the shoulder or flexion of the humerus. And the way that I told you that you should memorize that is by doing the parallel or analogous kind of motion at your hip, which is what? This. So that's flexion. All right, it's easy to see flexion at the... I didn't fall over, that's good. Okay, so that's flexion at the hip, but that's also flexion at the shoulder. So going from here to here is extension, and then moving my humerus posterior, straight posterior, that is hyperextension. Yeah, so don't forget that arm motion. It's kind of, unless you study it before the test, that's one you can't figure out during the test. Most you can figure out during a test by knowing the definition, but that flexion, I don't see what's going on there. You just have to memorize that. All right, so let's see. Where were we? I think we got done talking about abduction and adduction, right? Moving bones apart is abduction. Moving bones together is adduction. And if we combine flexion, extension, abduction, adduction at the shoulder, we can perform kind of a and rotation as well at the shoulder. If we add all those motions together, we get circumduction. All right, so this is circumduction, which is a windmill motion. Circumduction can only take place at two joints, and that's the shoulder and the hip, because those are ball and socket joints. Yeah. Okay. So let's see. We talked about rotation already before. Okay. A couple other motions. These might be kind of the more difficult to appreciate, but not too bad. And that is the motion that your hand goes through. So in anatomic position, which way are the palms facing? Which way are the palms facing? The palms are facing... Ah, you guys forgot all your test one stuff. Okay, your palms are facing... Yeah, this way toward the front is anterior. All right, so your palms are facing anterior. But your palms can just as well, without even rotating the humerus, your palms can face posteriorly. Okay, so we have to know what this motion is called. This motion is in the forearm right here. It's not. It has nothing to do with the humerus moving at all. All right, so when you move your palms so they face posteriorly, that is pronation, or my palms are pronated. When I move my palms of my hands anteriorly, we call that supination, or when they're facing anterior, that is a supinated position. Okay, so how can you remember that? Kind of easy for me, because I thought of, well, when you move your palms posteriorly, that's pronation, and there's just a lot of poetic P's when you say it that way, right? Palms facing posterior, that's pronation or pronated. And supination is if you put your hands together, it forms a soup bowl. Okay, somebody probably told you that already 20 times, but I thought I would just mention that again. Okay, so that's kind of a cute way to think of supination and pronation. The last motion has to do with your ankle joint. All right, and when you flex your elbow like this, all right, notice that your hand is raised, but it goes, what, anterior. When you flex, okay, so that's flexion of your forearm, but when you flex your leg, where does your leg go? Does it move anteriorly? It moves posteriorly. So how can I flex my leg? Is this flexing my leg? No, that's flexing my thigh. So flexing my leg is what motion? Like that, when I lift my heel up off the ground, all right, so that's flexion. So notice flexion of the forearm and flexion of the leg, your body parts move in different directions, so things are kind of messed up, right? So your upper appendage is not directly analogous to your lower appendage, and that's especially true for the ankle. Okay, so the knee is a lot different than the elbow, the way it bends, and the way the ankle bends is a lot different too. So flexion of the wrist, who can show me flexion of the wrist? Show me flexion. Yeah, flexion of the wrist, and what's this? Extension and then hyperextension. So flexion and extension of the wrist are easy to appreciate, but at the ankle, okay, because of the orientation of the bones, we say the two motions are dorsiflexion and plantar flexion. So both are a kind of flexion exercise. There isn't one that is an extension. When you lift your toes up off the ground, right, that's what we call dorsiflexion. So dorsiflexion is what? Pointing your toes kind of up in the air. And when you point your toes into the ground, that is what we call plantar flexion. So those are the two motions. Plantar flexion, dorsiflexion. And all of these motions are really important to appreciate. You know, it used to be when you go see a doctor or some kind of healthcare practitioner, they would be in the room and they would watch you walk in the room. And the good practitioners could tell what disease you had and how to treat you just by watching you walk in the room. Okay, and your affect and your gait and your equilibrium and if you were sneezing and coughing and spitting up stuff or whatever. But now how is it done? You're placed in a room and a couple hours later, right, somebody finally has time to come see you. Okay, so the contact time that you have with physicians is really limited. All right, but let's go back to that initial case when, you know, you actually walked someplace and somebody could observe how you walked. And even today, even if you're sitting in a room, you might notice a physician glancing down at your shoes. Okay, I go, aha, look at those shoes there. And what do you think they're looking for, especially if you're an elderly patient? They're looking to see if the tips of your shoes are worn off. Okay, because what does that mean if the tips of your shoes are worn? You're shuffling, in particular, what? Your toes. You're not lifting your toes off the ground. What motion is that patient deficient in? What motion is that, lifting your toes up off the ground? Yeah, that's dorsiflexion, and that can be an important clinical sign for something like spinal cord injury. Okay, that probably you wouldn't automatically think of that. All right, so if somebody's having trouble dorsiflexing, lifting their toes up off the ground, they wear their shoes out, but that's not such a big deal. Why could it be a really big deal? Yeah, because if you're walking, you could trip on a little crack in the sidewalk, okay, or a little buckle in the rug. And for your population, that's really not such a big deal because you'll cut yourself. But if you're like your grandma's age or something, okay, or grandpa's age, and you're not going to catch yourself, and when you fall, what usually happens? Yeah, you break like a hip bone, for instance, okay, which is an extended convalescence period, really can't take place at home, and you have to move into a convalescence home for maybe a month or so. And when those people are away from their normal surroundings, right, they lose who they are. They lose contact with their family, and a lot of people just kind of give up. So that could be what? That raises the mortality rate. So just observing very simple motions that people go through, you could save somebody's life as a result of that. Okay, so just looking for proper dorsiflexion is important clinically. So really appreciate all these different kinds of motions. All right, it has important ramifications for people's health and well-being and even life even. All right, so inversion and eversion. Okay, this is another motion that you go through with your ankle. When you try to stand on your lateral malleolus, that's called inversion. That's the easiest way to twist your ankle, is like that, all right? And standing on your medial malleolus, that's more difficult to twist your ankle that way. That's called an eversion. So invert and evert your ankle. Hopefully nobody has inverted or everted their ankle too many times by accident, okay? And then there's protraction and retraction of the mandible. Protraction is when you poke your mandible out, okay? Retraction is when you pull it back in underneath your head. This protraction, retraction, you can do that, but be careful. Don't hit your teeth together there when you do that. What happens here?
Yeah. Is there any, is there anything wrong if somebody has, a natural protection?
Of the mandible.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a motion of the temporomandibular joint. That's a complicated joint. And there is a lot of pathology with the temporomandibular joint associated with, and that can produce other kinds of disease processes. And you really need to talk to an expert about that TMJ joint. If it's popping, making sounds, grinding, or if you can't chew or something like that. Oh, yeah, you have a malocclusion. The teeth don't line up properly. And that's probably got a name, but it's not coming to my mind at the moment. What it's called when you have an overbite or an underbite. Maybe that's just what it's called in dentistry. Okay. Okay. And that may or may not have anything to do with a TMJ joint. Okay. But if you have a malocclusion, it might actually affect the TMJ joint, might cause it to go bad. So I would talk to a dentist about that. Okay, just to think of in the future and to protect yourself from things later on. All right, then of course, you can elevate the mandible for chewing. You can depress the mandible for putting food in your mouth. And your fingers, of course, can... What is this motion? Okay, it's close. I tricked you. Okay, this going from here to here is... abduction, and then moving your fingers together is adduction. All right. The other motion is, because we have a special joint in the thumb, we can move the thumb anterior to your pointing finger, and you can put the tips of these fingers together. That's opposition with the thumb. That's opposition with the thumb. And so as far as mammals go, that's kind of a special motion right here. All right. So those are the important motions that you should be familiar with. Okay. This is the chapter we want. All right, so here we are, right about here. All right, we can also talk about joints by the shape of the joints. This is one thing that stabilizes joints, right? It's just the shape of joints is something that can stabilize a joint. The joint capsule can stabilize a joint. Tendons and ligaments around a joint can stabilize a joint. But the most important thing that you can actually exercise to maintain the health of a joint is a muscle or muscles that go across a joint. So to help those muscles out, it's nice to know what the different kinds of joints are and what kind of motions are allowed. All right, a plain joint. We call this a transitional kind of motion. It's not around any particular kind of axis. It's not just a angulation, right? It's just a sliding. And these are between the intertarsals and intercarpal bones of the hand and the wrist. They're just kind of sliding motions. A hinge joint, uniaxial. A hinge joint just means that it allows only for strictly flexion and extension. No other kinds of motions take place. You can't abduct or adduct, right? You can't rotate at that joint. It's just a single simple motion. And an ankle would be a good example of that. Elbow and interphalangeal joint. Where's an interphalangeal joint? Between? I see some people pointing between a metacarpal and a phalanx. And that's not really it, all right? Not these knuckles right here, but these knuckles over here between the actual phalanges that make up your digits, right? And not your metacarpals. All right, so do we have any examples of these things right here? Nicely color-coded. Well, this one here looks like a hinge joint, all right? Oh, I can't really, and so D, What color is this right here?
Green.
Green. Okay, but it's this one right here, right? Biaxial. Biaxial. All right, so a biaxial, all right, that can be a condyloid joint, right, between a metacarpal and a phalanx. All right, so that's biaxial. So what can you do with that metacarpal and phalanx joint right there? You can, of course, flex and extend, but what else can you do? You can abduct and adduct, right? So there are two motions that you can do with that joint. That's kind of nice that way. All right, another one. A saddle joint between the first carpal and metacarpal. That is, which joint is that? Okay, but which one? Not all of them. Only your thumb. Okay, so that kind of joint, that saddle joint allows for opposition. Right, the saddle joint allows for opposition to take place. And then lastly, a ball and socket joint that's multiaxial. For instance, good examples of those, or the only two, would be the shoulder and the hip. And what are the motions that are allowed at the shoulder and the hip? So when we say multiaxial, it means all kinds of different motions, which means flexion, extension, abduction, adduction, rotation. All right, and if we put all those together, what do we get? Circumduction. Right, so you need a ball and socket joint for circumduction to take place. Okay, so those are the important kinds of joints to know, and the joints that you have to know in here. What should I give you exam figures for? For sure the knee. Did I give you the shoulder as well in your exam figures? Ah, pivot joint. Okay, a pivot joint allows for a rotation. And a good pivot joint, I guess I could think of three pivot joints. Let's see if we have any on this figure right here. A pivot joint, let me see. Ah, here we have a different kind. All right, so a pivot joint is between the head of the radius and what is this thing right here? This is the radial notch in the ulna, right? That's the radial notch in the ulna right here. So when you supinate and pronate, the head of the radius pivots, right, within this radial notch. Let's see what else. The pivot joint between C1 and C2 around the dens on C2. That's a pivot joint. And I said I could remember three. Well, I forgot what the third one was. But those are good for you to know, okay? The radial ulnar joint, the proximal radial ulnar joint, and then the joint between C1 and C2.
Question.
Yeah. Okay. Right here.
Okay.
Is that where I had it?
No, a little higher.
Here.
A little lower.
Oh, right here.
Right, a little
oh, right in here. Yeah.
That is the radial ulnar, not for that whole
time. Nope. It's only one. That's what we call the radial notch. The radial notch in the ulna. Okay? And if you look at the distal part of the humor of the radius, which I don't have on this slide right here, if you all look all the way, but this is the radius and this is the ulna, and there is, right in here is the radial notch. If you now just stay on the radius and go all the way down to the distal radius way down over here, you're going to see that it has a notch as well for the head of the ulna that will allow for supination and pronation. And that little divot, that little fossa in the radius down here is going to be called the ulnar notch. Right? So the ulnar notch is in the radius, but the radial notch is in the ulna. Okay? And those are special little joints that allow for pronation and supination. Okay, that's why those are there. Okay. All right, so there's a TMJ. Let's look at the shoulder joint, knee joint. Okay, what do you have to know about the knee joint? Let's look at this picture first. All right, so let's look at some superficial structures of the knee. And the knee basically is a hinge joint, which allows for flexion and extension. And this might be an exam figure, I'm not sure, but this one here is not. This is a little bit too complicated. All right, so we see a number of ligaments and tendons that span the knee joint right here. All right, so when it comes to the knee, make sure you know what bones are medial and which ones are lateral. So for instance, in the leg, what is the lateral bone in your leg? Yeah, the fibula. Which one's medial? Yeah, the tibia. All right, so just kind of get that in your mind. So here is a ligament that goes from the lateral epicondyle of the, this is the femur, way back over here, down to the fibula. So this is what we call the fibular collateral ligament. This is a lateral, or what we call a collateral ligament. All right, so you could call this the fibular collateral ligament, but it is also what? Lateral, you could call it a lateral collateral ligament. There's a similar one over here, right? This is the medial collateral ligament. But what is the medial bone in the leg? That's the tibia. So another name for it is the tibial collateral ligament. This helps stabilize the knee. So what do these ligaments do? That prevents what kind of motion? It stabilizes the knee. It prevents the knee from bending in which kind of way?
Lateral.
Okay, but what do we call that when it goes sideways? It prevents what? Abduction and adduction. The knee shouldn't abduct or adduct. If it does, guess what ligaments break? The collateral ligaments get ripped off. Okay, so that prevents abduction and adduction, the collateral ligaments. Okay, these retinaculi right here, I'm not going to ask you to know that, but you should know. This dense connective tissue right here, this is the tendon of the quadriceps muscle, which we're going to start to look at, and it inserts into the superior margin of the patella right here, and then off the apex of the patella, we have a bone-to-bone connection. If it's a bone-to-bone connection, we don't call that a tendon, we call that a ligament. That's the patellar ligament, but you can see that it does connect indirectly via the patella to the quadriceps, yeah. If it's not on the review, then you don't have to memorize this one. Yeah, but you might, I think you have to know those collateral ligaments. All right, so this is where those collateral ligaments are. I probably have another picture that has the collateral ligaments on it. Okay. All right, so here, this probably is one that you have to know because we can see some deeper internal structures. All right, but again, we see the tendon of the quadriceps, the patellar ligament, and then what is this one right here? This is the fibular collateral or lateral collateral ligament. Here's the medial collateral ligament, or you could call it the tibial collateral ligament. And within the knee, we have an articular disc. But in the knee, that articular disc we call the meniscus, right? So here is the lateral meniscus, and here is the medial meniscus, and they kind of have the shape of a C, and they just help mold the form of the condyle of the tibia to the condyles of the femur that stabilizes the joint quite a bit. Anybody remember what kind of cartilage that is right there? Yeah, the meniscus, what kind of cartilage is that? Okay. What are the three kinds of cartilage? You got fibrocartilage, elastic cartilage, and hyaline cartilage. All right, so don't forget, articular cartilage, like what I'm pointing to right now on the condyles, is what kind of cartilage? Now that's hyaline cartilage. What kind of cartilage then makes up the meniscus? It's fibrocartilage. It's a lot tougher. Fibrocartilage. But it can be ripped, and where it really has a tendency to tear, yeah, is right at the edge of the C's right there. Those just have a tendency to rip off. Okay. Now, I don't know what happens if they're popping around in there. You got to talk to somebody that knows something about the knee. Maybe they can glue it down in there or something. But if you have pieces of this meniscus moving around inside your knee, they might end up and wedge in and don't allow you to bend your knee, right? That's when your knee locks up. And then that little piece has to be taken out of there. All right, so here you can see the two menisces. The other two ligaments that you should become familiar with are what we call the cruciate ligaments. These are in the medial part of the knee, and why do we call them a cruciate ligament? Because they form a cross, right? They cross over each other. And so here is the anterior cruciate ligament. Here's the posterior. So you can see the insertion down over here is anterior. The insertion over here is posterior. That's how we name these particular ligaments. All right. And here's another diagram that shows them. So what do you think the function of this anterior cruciate ligament is? That prevents your leg right here from moving anteriorly, from protracting. All right, so your leg is always going to stay underneath your femur as a result of that. All right, but what if you get hit from behind, right, and your leg is pushed anteriorly? What ligament is going to be damaged? It's going to be the anterior cruciate ligament. All right, the posterior cruciate ligament is going to prevent what? Retraction of the knee. But if you get hit in the front, right, and stretches that or breaks that ligament, then it's the posterior cruciate ligament that gets damaged. All right, so those are all the structures that you have to know. The two collateral ligaments, the two cruciate ligaments, and the menisci, right, the medial and lateral menisci, and then the patellar ligament and patellar tendon. Those are the ones that you have to know about the knee. So it's actually pretty easy to see. Spend any time in lab, those are going to just pop out at you, right? And that might even be on the practicum, I think, maybe this week, right? Because you have joints on your practicum?
No.
Oh, you didn't have joints? Oh, it was just bones? Ah, okay. Well, next time. Okay. Okay. But make sure everybody has the same practicum. If you're still taking a practicum this week or maybe Monday, make sure you know what's on that test. Because I'm not teaching that lab, I might not know exactly what's on your test in your particular section. Okay. All right, so that's all the exam figures that I want you to know about for joints. Types of joints, know joints by their structure and by their function. Okay, so tell me something about classification of joints by structure. What kind of joints are there? There are? Yeah, there's only three. There's fibrous joints, there's cartilaginous joints, and then there are synovial joints. Right, so fibrous joints have fibers in them. Cartilaginous joints have cartilage in them. Synovial joints have what in them?
Fluid.
But don't forget, there's a whole list of structures, right? There's what? The hyaline cartilage. There is the synovial membrane, which secretes the synovial fluid into the synovial cavity. And then you have a fibrous capsule outside the synovial membrane. And the synovial membrane and the fibrous capsule makes the joint capsule, right? So there's a whole bunch of structures with a synovial joint. But why is it fun to learn about a synovial joint? Why are synovial joints special? Don't think about their structure necessarily, think about their function. What's the function of a synovial joint? All of them are diarthroses. And what does a diarthroses mean? Freely movable, right? Freely movable. So that's why it's actually nice to know and memorize a lot about synovial joints, because those are the ones that we really utilize all the time. And those are the ones that we're really concerned with if we abuse a joint somehow or another. Okay. All right, so does anybody have any questions on joints at all? Okay. All right, so that's it for joints. So I think we're going to move on to 10. I thought I heard a question. No question? Huh? Yeah. What does bone remodeling involve? Okay. Well, I think of cells. Okay, so my first question would be, what kind of cell do you find in mature bone? An osteocyte. And where are osteocytes located? In lacunae, and the lacunae are connected to each other by canaliculi, right? So you have that little picture in your mind. But when you remodel a bone, maybe it got broken. All right, and so even if it's a healthy bone that you start to exercise and it needs to be remodeled to handle more tension or stress or something, I immediately think of two other important cells that are bone cells. What are those? Osteoclasts and osteoblasts. All right, so what's the function of an osteoclast? It breaks down bone. It dissolves bone away. All right, and then guess what? There's an antagonistic cell to an osteoclast. That is the osteoblast that builds bone back up. So when you remodel bone, what you have to do is break it down a little bit with an osteoclast, and then osteoblasts come in and rebuild it the way it should be built back up. So there's a balance between activity of osteoclasts and osteoblasts. And if the balance is lost, right, you might end up with osteoporosis, for instance. If the osteoclasts are working harder than the blasts, then you lose bone density, right? But in a younger population like all of us here in the room, okay, it's nicely balanced. So we still have nice strong bones as a result of that. So the other thing about bone remodeling is, remember, how long do you keep your skeleton for?
5 years.
Yeah, only for about 5 years, right? Because another way of saying it is that every 5 years your bones are completely replaced and remodeled because of the activity of osteoclasts and osteoblasts. Right, so you have a new skeleton. So if you want a bigger, stronger skeleton, because maybe you do not want osteoporosis, right, which all of us will experience as we get older, what should you do? You got to exercise. You got to stress those bones so that when you're the process of remodeling them every 5 years, those osteoblasts make them even bigger and stronger. That will protect you from osteoporosis when we become geriatric people. Okay. I suppose maybe it depends a little bit on your diet. It probably depends on your activity level. I would guess if you exercise a lot, your bones probably will turn over faster even than that. Okay? So they're going just like your muscles. If you stop using a muscle, it's going to get smaller and atrophy. If you start using a muscle, it'll get bigger and stronger. Same thing for your bones. Yeah, so I wouldn't say it's absolutely constant. It changes with things. Okay, here's a sign-in sheet. Good thing I remembered. All right, so as the sign-in sheet is moving around, let me find the next slides for us to look at. Okay, so don't forget, we got a test coming up. It's going to be similar. It's going to be similar. Yeah. I sure hope so. Yeah. Yeah. In case you have some like last minute questions or something. Okay. Or did you want me to like bring in a test to give you another test? Oh, you would like to do that too? Okay. Yeah. Okay, wait a second, I got lost here. All right, so 10. Where's 10? Okay, so this is an introductory chapter to muscle. We're not going to learn a whole lot of different muscles and origins, insertions of muscles, names of nerves that are going to muscles, or actions that various muscles perform on our body, but this is just an introductory chapter. All right, so what kind of tissue is muscle? It is what? A tissue all by itself, right? Muscle tissue is muscle tissue. And in this particular chapter, we're going to look mostly at voluntary muscle. What kind of muscle is voluntary as opposed to involuntary muscle? So voluntary muscle is skeletal muscle, and as a matter of fact, skeletal muscle is the only organ or organ system that you have voluntary control over. That's the only thing that you can control with your mind and your whole body. It doesn't mean that other things are not controlled or uncontrolled, but they're controlled by an autonomic nervous system. But your skeletal muscles are controlled by a voluntary nervous system. All right, so muscles are specialized to contract, right? So here are some functions. Because muscles contract, that provides for movement. When your body is moving, bones are moving, you need muscles to contract to have those bones articulate or move with respect to each other, flexion, extension, etc., etc. All right, but even if you're not moving, you need muscles. You need a muscle right now? Do you need any muscles right now? Yeah, because? Why? What happened if all your muscles were to relax? Yeah, you'd hit your head on the table and then on the chair and then on the floor, right? You'd end up on the floor. So even though you're not moving, you have to use muscles just to maintain body posture. That's real important. All right, and then muscles are also important for joint stabilization so that when you are actually using a joint, making a couple bones move, there are other muscles that aren't making the joint move. They're holding other joints in position so that everything works properly. So we call that joint stabilization. And then muscles are important for generating body heat. So is that important? Because if our muscles stop generating body heat, what would happen to our body temperature right now? It would drop because the room temperature is a lot lower than 98 degrees. As a matter of fact, if the room temperature was 98, we'd be all really uncomfortable. All right, so muscles are important for maintaining our body temperature. All right, so there are some special characteristics that separate muscle tissue from other kinds of tissues. And these special properties are what? Contractility. All right, so that means shortening. But muscles don't have to contract all the time. They can contract and relax. And as a matter of fact, that's under voluntary control if it's skeletal muscle. So muscles can contract or relax depending on circumstances. So we say that muscle tissue is excitable. Right? We can excite it into contracting. And if we don't excite it, guess what happens to it? It relaxes. Muscle tissue is also extensible. So that means that muscles can stretch, which is a really good thing because let's think of our two antagonistic muscles that we were working with before, namely the biceps and the triceps. When the biceps contracts, guess what has to happen to the triceps? It has to stretch, right? Yeah, it has to extend. All right, so extensibility is important. And when the triceps contracts, guess what happens to the biceps? It has to extend. So extensibility is an important property. And then the last important property is elasticity. And that is, if you stretch a muscle and then release the tension, what happens to that muscle? It goes back to its original position, right? So all of these are important and distinct concepts that you should be aware of. All right, so here are the three kinds of muscle. I think in tissues we looked at these already, skeletal, cardiac, and smooth. But we'll look in a little bit more detail in this chapter. And don't forget, a skeletal muscle and even a smooth muscle cell is called a fiber. But cardiac muscle is not really called a fiber. And these muscle cells are called fibers because they're long and narrow. They look like a thread or a fiber. They're not just a collagen fiber, but they're really long and narrow. Okay. So let's look at skeletal muscle first. And let's look at a gross level in terms of anatomy. And when I say gross, what does that mean? That means big. You don't need any microscope or anything to see it, right? All right, so at a gross level, here is a picture of a muscle. And this could be, for instance, a biceps muscle, or I guess I can see on the slide that's a brachioradialis, right, that goes across your elbow joint and that causes flexion of the forearm. So this is what we call a muscle, this whole big thing right over here. And sometimes we might just call this big pouch of the muscle, the belly of the muscle, or muscle belly, right? And if we look at the whole muscle, we see that it connects to bone via this dense regular connective tissue that we call a tendon. So a tendon is a muscle-to-bone connection. And that's connective tissue, so that's not really muscle. That connective tissue is continuous with connective tissue that surrounds the whole muscle. And that's what we call the epimysium. Okay, epimysium that surrounds, oh, wait a second. Yeah, that surrounds the whole muscle. Okay, epimysium. All right, and when we look at the whole muscle in transverse section, we can see that there are bundles inside the muscle. And those bundles sometimes are called fascicles. So you could call this a muscle bundle or a muscle fascicle. Let's see, I think we like fascicle in this book. So I see a number of muscle fascicles right here. And furthermore, there is a membrane system around every fascicle, and we call that the perimysium. All right, that's another membrane, connective tissue. And what do you see inside of a fascicle? You see even more units right here. Okay? So what builds a fascicle up are a number of muscle fibers. And what's a muscle fiber? That's just another name for a cell. Okay, so a muscle fiber is a cell. So this is just a drawing. Muscle cells aren't nearly this big. You can't see them with your naked eye, but this is just so that we can look at all these structures at one time. Okay, and then there is a connective tissue sheath around every single muscle fiber or muscle cell, and we call that the endomysium. Okay, the endomysium around every cell. All right, so if we have a big muscle right here, that has muscle fibers in it, what do we get when we put a bunch of muscle fibers together? We get a fascicle, and when we put a bunch of fascicles together, we get the whole muscle. We get the whole muscle organ, right? Okay. And just remember the names of these different connective tissue sheaths around those different components right there. All right. Oh, what I do, another thing I see on this slide, all right, look at the appearance of this muscle fiber. Does it have a uniform color to it? Or do you see some structure inside a muscle fiber right here? You see some structure. It's a repeating pattern. What do we call that repeating pattern? That's a striation. Right, that's a striation. All right, so skeletal muscle is striated. All right, so did I cover all this? The tendon, the muscle belly, epimysium, the fascicle, perimysium, fiber, endomysium. Great. Okay. All right. So muscles, for most muscles, attach on either end to a bone. And those attachment points we give special names to because usually one of the bones is held pretty steady while the other bone moves a lot. So one insertion point or one attachment point is called the origin if it's attached to the less movable end of a muscle, and the insertion is the more movable end of the muscle. So let's take a look at this muscle right here. So here is when the elbow is extended. Here's when it's flexed. So here is a contracting muscle. So when this muscle contracts, guess what bone moves? Does the humerus move, right, for instance, or does the ulna move? The ulna moves, right? So since the ulna is moving, this end of the muscle is called the insertion because it's the more movable end. The less movable end is what we call the origin. And in most cases in your body, the origin is always going to be superior to the insertion. But that's not always the case. We could come up with a lot of exceptions to that particular rule, but that's always a good thing to think of first. Okay, the origin is always going to be superior, the insertion is inferior. Anybody have a question about that? How we name? Some tendons are direct attachments because there's a very, very short tendon. The muscle appears attached to the bone, right? Like we see right here. All right, an indirect attachment is when the muscle is really far away from the bone, so there has to be a long length of tendon between the muscle and the bone. So don't forget, a tendon is a muscle-to-bone connection. And what is a bone-to-bone connection called?
Ligament.
Yeah, that's a ligament. Okay. Okay. All right, so now let's move from a gross perspective to a more microscopic perspective of a muscle. Okay, a muscle fiber is a single, very long, cylindrical, multi-nucleate cell. So it's kind of strange because most cells have just one nucleus, but muscle fibers have many. And that's because during development, a muscle fiber was thousands of individual cells that fused together, and all of those organelles remain in that one fused cell. Okay. All right, so we develop a little terminology to talk about cells. The plasma membrane on a muscle fiber is what we call the sarcolemma. So anytime you see that term sarco, what should you be thinking of? You should think of a skeletal muscle cell, okay? Or skeletal muscle. It has something to do with skeletal muscle. The cytoplasm is called the sarcoplasm. That's just the the cytoplasm inside, a muscle cell. And the smooth endoplasmic reticulum inside of a skeletal muscle cell is called the sarcoplasmic reticulum. All right, so what did you learn as the function for a smooth endoplasmic reticulum? Did you have to learn functions of organelles? Like what organelle makes ATP?
Mitochondria.
What organelle makes proteins? Rough endoplasmic reticulum. Right. What did you learn for smooth endoplasmic reticulum? Makes lipids. Right. And hopefully I remembered this and put on your slides, but smooth ER also has another important function, especially in skeletal muscle, and that is that it stores calcium, right? Calcium ions. So you think that usually we have a lot of calcium in bones, but it's important to have calcium inside muscle cells as well for them to contract. And we're going to see how important calcium is. That calcium comes from the smooth endoplasmic reticulum when the muscle gets excited, and that causes contraction. Okay. All right, so let's look at some building blocks of a muscle fiber. The building blocks are myofibrils. And inside myofibrils, we have myofilaments. All right, let's see if we can find a picture of some of these things. Ah, here is a nice picture of a muscle fiber. And how many nuclei do I see right here? I see 1, 2, 3. So at least in this very short section, I see 3 nuclei. I can see striations very easily. There are dark bands and light bands. The dark bands, we call them the A bands. The light bands, we call the I bands. And it appears obvious on this slide why we call the A band the A band. Because there's an A in dark. And the I band, there's an I in light. But that's not the reason why they got named that way. It's just because of the way that they bend polarized light. All right, but at least that's a really handy technique to know how to name those bands. The dark ones are the A bands and the light ones are the I bands. One comes right after the other through the whole length of the muscle fiber. Okay, so this, don't forget, is a cell, right? Here's a muscle cell, but it has building blocks. And the building block of a muscle cell is a myofibril. So usually if you look inside of a cell and you see a structure, what's a general name for a specialized structure inside a cell called? An organelle. That's right. So you could think of all of these myofibrils that are building blocks of this muscle cell right here as an organelle. And these are the organelles for contraction, are the myofibrils. And you can see that they're very long and tubular. They go the whole length of the cell. And these A bands and I bands in one myofibril line up with the I bands and A bands of the neighboring myofibrils, right? So they all line up together, and so when you look at skeletal muscle, because everything lines up, it has this nice striated appearance. It's not just a homogeneous mix of all those different colorations. Okay. So now let's look within a myofibril, as a matter of fact, inside the cell, how many myofibrils do you see in there? Lots. That's a good answer, right? You don't have to count them, but there are lots. There are many, many, many of them. So these are the contractile units or organelles inside the cell. And furthermore, there are things that make up a myofibril. So let's pull out a myofibril and look inside a myofibril. And again, there are long tubular kinds of structures inside of a myofibril. If we look at the end over here, they just appear as dots. Some of the dots are thicker than others, right? And these dots just represent these long tubular thread-like structures inside of a myofibril. And these are what we call myofilaments. And these are the proteins that allow the muscle to contract, myofilaments. Okay. So I think maybe we should break down. Oh, and there's two. Let me finish this, and then we'll put muscles back together. We'll build a muscle with building blocks. There are two kinds of important myofilaments inside of a muscle cell. There are these that we call the myosin filament or myofilament, and there are thin ones that we call actin. All right. So there's actin and myosin myofilaments. Which one is the thick one? Myosin, and the thin one is the actin, right? And you can see that they interdigitate. They overlap, and You don't ever find two myosin filaments next to each other. Another way of saying that is, what kind of filament do you see lying next to a myosin? Is an actin. And what do you see next to an actin molecule? Only myosin, right? Actin and actin don't interact. Myosin and myosin doesn't interact. The interaction is always between a myosin and an actin right here. And then, of course, you can see on this diagram that the actin is sometimes called the thin filament because it is a lot thinner. All right, so if you want to build a myofibril, what do you have to have available? What are the building blocks of a myofibril? Okay, you have to have actin and myosin. All right, these are what we call myofilaments. In order to make a myofibril, which is this thing right here, you need myofilaments. You put myofilaments together. All right, and if you have myofibrils and you put a bunch of myofibrils together, what can you make? You can make a, what is this?
Myofibril.
Okay, you can make a, if you put a bunch of these together, you can make a fiber, right? And then if you put a bunch of fibers together, what do you get? If you put a bunch of fibers together, here are a bunch of fibers, you get a fascicle. And if you put a bunch of fascicles together, you get a muscle. All right, so that's something, some kind of structure that you should put in your memory. All right, so let's go the other way. Let me ask a question. What's the basic building block of a muscle? It's going to be fascicles. What's the building block of a fascicle? It's a fiber. And what's the building block of a fiber? I don't want to show you the picture, but try to remember what it is. What is the building block? It's a myofibril. And what's the building block of a myofibril? Myofilaments. And then you should remember, how many kinds of myofilaments are there? There are two kinds of filaments. There's thick and thin. Yes. Question. Question? Oh, no, you're just thinking. Okay. All right, so make sure that you can go forwards and backwards in that level of organization of muscle. Okay? All right, who doesn't see a way to understand that? I mean, you might not have a really clear picture in your mind right now, but can you, does anybody can't appreciate how they could ever understand that if they look at those pictures on their own? Okay, so you just have to apply yourself a little bit and just go up and down that level of organization a couple times. All right, so those are the myofilaments right there. Okay, striations. You have the A-band and the I-band. The A-band is a darkly shaded band due to a length of myosin, because myosin is thick. It blocks a lot of light. And the I-band is due to segments of muscle fiber where you only have actin. Actin is really thin. It allows a lot of light to pass through. Therefore, it has a light appearance to it. All right. Well, now I want to talk about the structural and functional unit of muscle contraction. And if you understand how this unit contracts, then you have a really good idea of how all muscles contract. And I like to use that as an example a lot in this class. And we talked about the structural and functional unit of life. What's the structural and functional unit of life? The cell. That's right. So if you know how a cell works, you know a lot about the workings of life. And I don't think I talked much about the structural and functional unit of anything else yet, but I will mention it a number of times for different things. And for muscle, it is the sarcomere. So the sarcomere is a structural and functional unit of contraction or shortening. Okay, and what is a sarcomere made up of? Well, it's made up of primarily myofilaments, which are myosin and actin, and they're arranged in a repeating unit over and over and over again. So here is the graphical representation of what one sarcomere looks like. The ends of a sarcomere we call the Z lines or the Z disc. Right here, okay, and that's really easy to remember, that those are the endpoints of a sarcomere, because what is Z? Z is the end of the alphabet, right? So Z is just the endpoint of the alphabet, and there really is no difference between this Z disc here and this one over here. And you can see what protein is attached to the Z disc. Is it the myosin or the actin? It's the actin molecule that's attached to the Z-disc. The myosin molecule is attached indirectly via this thing right here that looks like a little spring. This is what we call a titin molecule. All right, this titin, thin, do I see titin? I don't see titin on this slide, but it's right in the middle. Okay, I can't see it, but right here is titin. Ah, here, titin, oh, titin, little titin. Okay, that's it. These are little elastic proteins that help keep myosin in their place. All right, that's their job. But also, when you stretch the sarcomere out, guess what that titin does? It provides for elasticity. It brings the sarcomere back together. Not with a lot of power, but that just happens after you stretch a muscle. Okay. All right, so from here to here, right, this whole area right here is what we're going to call what band? What band is this going to be right in here? This is the A band, right, or the dark band, because the myosin is really thick. And then from here, way over to here, before you get to the next myosin, what band is this right here? That's going to be the I band, right? That's going to be the light band. And then we have a couple other things besides the Z discs and the A and I bands. We also have an M line. Guess why they call that M line right there? Because that's right in the middle of the dark band. All right, so those are, this might be an exam figure. You might have to know the names of these different bands, the names of these different proteins, myosin, actin, and the titin molecule right here. Okay. And so that was an illustration. Here is an actual picture, an electron micrograph. So here is the Z disc, and then on either side of the Z disc, because what's attached to the Z disc is the actin, right? That's the actin molecule, and the actins are real thin, so that's not very opaque, and so that forms a light band. And then in the middle of the sarcomere, you have the A band, that's the dark band right there, and then running down right through the middle is the M line. Okay. Right here? Yeah. So where does the sarcomere go from? It goes from this Z disc to this Z disc right here. That's a sarcomere. And the way to appreciate that is what protein attaches to the Z disc? It is a thin actin molecule, and so it appears very light. The thicker molecules, the myosin, form the middle part of a sarcomere, and because they're so thick, it makes the sarcomere really dark as a result of that. Was that your question? Oh, the I band? The I band actually goes, includes two neighboring sarcomeres. So it goes like from right here all the way up to here. Okay, and the Z disc is going to be right in the middle of an I band. And underneath a light microscope, which what we use in lab, we usually can't even see the Z disc right here because we don't have the resolution to see it. Okay, so underneath the light microscope, you see what? You see a light area and a dark area, followed by a light area, followed by a dark area. That's usually what you see with a light microscope. This is a really fancy one. This is an electron microscope. Okay? All right, yeah, look at it a couple times. Okay. All right. Okay. So we talked about all these different things. Let's look at some of the structure associated with the different proteins that make up a sarcomere. So we want to focus our attention on the sarcomere. And one question that I usually like to ask is, again, what's the function of a muscle cell? What's it specialized to do?
To contract.
So it's going to shorten. All right, so now we know the names of some proteins in that sarcomere, namely, what, the actin and myosin, those are the two most important. Which ones of those contract? Which ones of those shorten to cause the sarcomere to shorten? So that's what we're going to look at now. All right, so you don't have to answer me because we don't know yet. Okay. All right, so here is one of those proteins. Which one is this? This is the myosin, right? And it's stabilized because it's kind of attached to the midline right here, but don't forget it's also got those titin molecules on either end. All right, and then surrounding this myosin molecule is going to be actin, right? So there's going to be an association between this myosin and actin right here. So now let's really zoom into this myosin molecule and look at a lot of its fine detail. And we can see that it has a number of rod-like structures, and then every once in a while, it has these things poking up off of the myosin molecule, and we call this right here a myosin head group, here and here. Okay, these poke up off of the myosin, and under certain conditions, what can this head group do? It can reach up and bind to an actin molecule. So they can actually touch and they can actually bind, all right? And this right here, when it binds, we call that a cross bridge. So there can be cross bridges that form between actin and myosin, not between any of the other proteins in the sarcomere, but just between actin and myosin, okay? All right, and that's what causes the sarcomere to shorten, the binding of actin to myosin, and we'll talk about that in just a little bit, but let's look and see what actually shortens. So here is a sarcomere at rest. Here's one that's partially contracted, and then here's a sarcomere that is fully contracted. All right, now what does your eye see? Let's just compare the relaxed state compared to this contracted state over here. And what did you see move? What do you see really moving right here? We say it's shortening because the Z discs are doing what? They're being pulled closer together. Yeah, you got it. The Z discs are being pulled closer together. All right, and let's see what protein actually shortens. This myosin protein right here, does it look the same as this one right here? Okay, well, it might be just a little bit of an optical illusion, but if I could get up there with a ruler, this length of the myosin molecule should equal this length right here. Myosin doesn't really shorten. Okay, what other molecule are we interested in? How about the actin molecule? And if I could get up there and measure the length of this actin molecule, we're going to see that it is the same length as this one right here. All right, so neither the actin or myosin shorten when the sarcomere contracts or gets shorter in length when the Z discs come together. All right, so what explanation could you use? Yeah, the actin and myosin molecules do what? They slide over each other. And since the actin molecules are attached to the Z discs, okay, then the Z discs get pulled together. So here I have two markers. I got this blue and green marker right here. If we put them together, you can see that it's a long length, right? But if we let these markers slide over, right, what has happened to my hands? They've come closer together, but what about the length of each one of those markers? Are they the same or did they shorten? They shortened? No, they're the same length. Each marker is the same length. All right, so here are those two markers. My hands are far apart. All right, the blue marker, let's just say, is myosin, and the green is actin. All right, and let's not change their shape. Let's just let them slide over each other like this. So now, what's the distance between my hands? It's shorter. Yeah, it's half, as a matter of fact. Perfect, it's half. But what about the length of the markers? Same length, because they just slid over each other. So that's how we envision how muscle contraction takes place, and the model that we articulate in our minds is called the sliding filament model for muscle contraction. So why do we say sliding filament? Because actin and myosin are what? They're myofilaments, right? They just slide over each other. As a result, then the Z discs come closer together. So to answer that question, which protein actually shortens in the sarcomere, you would say E. None of the above, right? Because there isn't a muscle protein that shortens. They do what? They just slide over each other and the Z discs come together. So that's pretty ingenious, all right, whoever figured this out. And they were looking at micrographs like this, okay, to figure it out, and probably a couple people won some Nobel Prizes to figure that out. Now, what bands actually disappear when a muscle contracts? What band don't you see here anymore? The I band disappears. Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, you were wrong. Oh, okay. The I band disappears. Okay. But see, now this one right here, right in the middle, right along this M line right here, This sort of has an intermediate color when the muscle is relaxed. That's what we call the H zone. That H zone also goes away. I don't know if you mentioned that. I didn't quite hear what you said. But this light band, notice this light band goes away because now the whole length of the sarcomere is filled up with what? This big dark myosin molecule. So the eye band goes away and you're just left with what? A really dark appearance of the whole sarcomere. That's when the muscle is contracted. Yeah. So you hardly see what? Any eye band whatsoever. Okay, so that's probably some kind of review question for you. Okay. All right, let me go back to the word slide and let's see what I kind of missed right here. I'm going to have to see what kind of pictures I have for these things. Let's move down a little bit further and talk about this picture right here. Okay, so don't forget this. What do we call this structure right here that I'm circling on this slide? This is the muscle fiber or muscle cell, same thing, right? And here is the nucleus, right? And here you can see from right here to right here is a sarcomere, right? That's a... Okay, well, I'll tell you what. Yeah, let's break this down a little bit. Let's look at the big structure. The big structure right here is a fiber. That's a muscle fiber. Here's one nucleus, but don't forget there are many nuclei inside the cell. And the building block of a muscle fiber is a myofibril. Look at all these myofibrils inside there. That's the organelle of contraction. And what makes up a myofibril are going to be myofilaments, and if we look on the end of this myofibril right here, I can see what? At least the myosin myofilaments right here. All right, so if we pull out a myofibril into this region, here's a number of myofibrils, right? This is the sarcolemma or the plasma membrane of the cell. Here's the plasma membrane of the cell. What did we call the plasma membrane of a cell? That's the sarcolemma. All right, so here are a number of myofibrils with the plasma membrane around them. We see a number of different structures, and they're nicely color-coded, so we can see them pretty easily. All right, so here's the cell membrane. We see some tubes that are, what, like a gold color? Yellow, gold. These are what we call transverse tubules, or T-tubules for short, because what kind of section through this muscle fiber is this right here? That's a transverse section, and these tubules kind of follow along those same lines. So these are what we call transverse tubules. And these transverse tubules allow for the distribution of an electrical signal. So the way that muscle gets excited is that there is an electrical signal on the cell membrane, and that electrical signal has to get deep down inside the muscle cell and excite all of these myofibrils, and the easiest way to do that is to have that electrical signal go through this T-tubule, so the T-tubule is acting almost like a little wire distributing that electrical signal, right, the T-tubule. You see that little hole right here in the membrane? That's how the electrical signal gets deep inside the cell. And as the electrical signal gets deep inside the cell, it stimulates this tissue right here, which is blue, or this organelle. That's blue. Is that blue? Yeah?
Purple.
Yeah. Okay. Same color to me. Purple. And this is the smooth endoplasmic reticulum. What do we call smooth endoplasmic reticulum in skeletal muscle cell? That's called the sarcoplasmic reticulum. Sarcoplasmic reticulum. What's the job of sarcoplasmic reticulum? It's in a skeletal muscle cell is to store calcium. It stores calcium. All right, but when that electrical signal comes down the T-tubule, right, it stimulates the sarcoplasmic reticulum to release that calcium. So calcium rushes into the myofibril and it surrounds all of the myofilaments, a high calcium. And that's going to be the signal that's used to get the myofilaments to slide over each other. It's going to cause sliding of the myofilaments. Okay, so this association right here with the ends of two sarcoplasmic reticuli with the transverse tubule. Sometimes we call that a triad. All right, so here is a triad. One piece of a sarcoplasmic reticulum, a T-tubule, and a neighboring end piece of the sarcoplasmic reticulum. So sometimes this end piece of the sarcoplasmic reticulum we call the terminal cisternae. Right, so you got a right and left terminal cisternae with a T-tubule. I'll tell you what, what's the name of the structure if we take a T-tubule and two ends of the cisternae of two neighboring sarcoplasmic reticulums? That's what we call a triad. Okay, that's a triad. So here's one terminal cisternae, here's a T-tubule, here's a second terminal cisternae of another end of a sarcoplasmic reticulum. So that's what we call a triad. All right, so where do we find these T-tubules? They correspond to every Z-disc right here. So at the ends of every sarcomere, there is a T-tubule. Surrounding every myofibril is a sarcoplasmic reticulum that is storing calcium, which is going to be used as a signal to excite this particular muscle and cause contraction. I would say a sarcomere goes from a Z-disc to Z-disc. Yeah, it goes from Z-disc to Z-disc. And Z, I say that because Z is what? The endpoint of our alphabet. Okay. So I think this one right here is an exam figure, right? Because everything is labeled. The I-bands are labeled, the Z-disc and the H-zone, M-line, A-band. All these are labeled, plus all of these internal structures around the myofibrils. All right, so this is a really good picture. The other thing that I see that's not labeled on here is this thing right here. So in order for a muscle to contract, guess what it needs? It needs energy. What form of energy does a muscle need to contract? It needs ATP. What's an organelle that makes ATP? Mitochondria. And what does this look like right here? You see all those membranes on the inside? So that's a mitochondria that's making ATP. Guess what that ATP is going to be used to do?
To slide
the actin and myosin over each other. All right, so next time when we come back, a week from today, we're going to see how that electrical signal, how it's coupled to the sliding of the actin and myosin filaments. And if after the test, if you want to read something to get ready for that lecture, go ahead and read about excitation-contraction coupling in your book. Okay? If you want some more excitement after the test, anatomy excitement, read excitation-contraction coupling in your book.
But you recorded it right.
Yeah, I did. I think I got it. It didn't turn off. Okay, before you leave, hold on. I have an important message maybe